It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at chronic student absenteeism during the pandemic and how it's still affecting schools today. First, suppose you want to eat right, healthy, and you want to know the best science behind the food you eat. But when you start to dig into things, the results of nutritional studies can seem confusing, maybe even contradictory. Is coffee good for our health or not? I hope so. Could a glass of red wine a day help keep the doctor away? The scientific consensus for a lot of questions like these isn't always clear. It's probably safe to assume that at least an apple a day won't hurt us. There's pretty solid evidence on fruits and veggies. But what if a nutritional study found that a daily dose of your favorite ice cream could provide some health benefits? On average, we eat more than 20 pounds of ice cream and frozen desserts every year. That's a lot of sugar and saturated fats. How is it possible there could be a health benefit to that? We're in Wisconsin. We might want it to be true. Our next guest reported on findings that suggest it might be true. But the idea has gotten a chilly reception from many researchers. We'll follow that story and then talk to a local registered dietitian nutritionist about how we can use what the science says about our food to make better health decisions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you try to follow what the science says about nutrition? Have you tried and given up? And with ice cream, how often do you eat it? Would you eat ice cream more if there really were a health benefit? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Johns is a public health historian and a journalist. He recently wrote a piece in The Atlantic titled Nutrition Science's Most Preposterous Result. You can find a link to that story at WPR.org/Central Time. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
What started you down this ice cream trail, David?
Well, I got this funny tip from somebody kind of in the broader public health world that I was talking to for a completely different reason that basically, a doctoral student at Harvard had hit upon this very surprising finding that consuming about a half cup of ice cream a day was associated with a reduced risk of heart problems among diabetics. And, you know, obviously this was like a very strange result, not exactly what a doctoral student was, expecting to find. It was something that was met with a lot of skepticism by the kind of more senior scientists at Harvard School of Public Health there, one of the most influential nutrition departments in the country. But as I looked into it, and as I this was just sort of like funny for me at first, or this kind of curiosity. But as I dug into it, I discovered that actually there was this kind of puzzling paper trail in the scientific literature that went back a couple decades that other researchers had found this, where basically eating ice cream was associated with a lower risk of diabetes, which was just like too, you know, so surprising and such a curious thing that I had to dig in further and write about it.
As the scientists you talked to in writing this article looked into that, what did they do to try to figure out, what's wrong with these numbers, which was, I think, their working assumption?
Yeah, at first they were like, okay, you know, there's random, weird, spurious results can pop up all the time in science. That's completely, you know, typical of scientific research. And in this case, the findings were based on large-scale observational epidemiology studies, which is where they basically start with a healthy population and they follow them over time. They keep track of what they eat based on dietary questionnaires, and they associate what they're eating with various kinds of health outcomes. In this case, they were looking at, metabolic disease and diabetes. So at first they were like, okay, we got to just check the numbers. You know, maybe there was a data entry error. Maybe there was just something that we didn't, we forgot to check for some kind of confounding or some kind of bias that was in the data. But basically they did that and it all checked out. They tried all kinds of different ways for testing this particular dissertation finding that I'm describing, and they basically couldn't make it go away, right? So then they, from there, as they dug into this question further, there were other kinds of explanations that they hit upon that they think might explain the finding in a way that doesn't suggest that ice cream is actually the cause of, a reduced risk of diabetes. I can explain that further if you want me to.
Yeah, one of those reasons, as I understand it, and I've seen this and talked about on the air about alcohol, is the idea that, if I'm getting less healthy, I might have cause to avoid foods that I think are unhealthy, like, say, ice cream. So that might be adding unhealthy people to the no ice cream side of the equation and skewing the results. How did scientists look at that part of the story?
Exactly. So this is a phenomenon called reverse causation. This is one possible explanation for how people kind of explain this ice cream finding. Like maybe the easiest way to think about reverse causation is, you know, in these studies, even though they're following people over time, they're not, the data that they're collecting is not super granular. So sometimes you can't tell whether the effect caused the disease or the disease caused the effect in a, or the exposure rather. So like a really simple way of understanding this is in the scientific literature, then there have been connections found between mouthwash use and mouth cancer. Right. So when these first popped up, people are like, maybe mouthwash causing mouth cancer. Actually, based on a little further digging, they discovered that no, people with mouth cancer were having bad breath. So they were using mouthwash. So it was the disease that was causing the exposure, not the exposure causing the disease. And as you said, the theory with regard to this ice cream stuff was basically like maybe some of the people were developing kind of like pre-diabetes. And so those people were either being told by their doctors or kind of other of their own volition, like, I got high cholesterol, I got high blood pressure. Maybe I need to cut back on, you know, a range of foods that they think of as unhealthy. So kind of the sick people or the people who were getting sick were cutting back on ice cream. So the only people who were left eating ice cream were the healthier people. So that might skew the data a little bit. There's other explanations for how it could be, or it could be real.
Talking to David Johns about a piece in the Atlantic titled Nutrition Science's Most Preposterous Result, looking at the science and nutrition of ice cream. Now, David, another complicated thing is a lot of these reports you write are self-reported. You might ask me, Rob, how much ice cream actually is frozen custard? How much frozen custard did you eat yesterday? Oh, a couple scoops. Well, Rob, scoops are pretty big, right? Like how we report how much we eat might skew the data.
Exactly. So the data here are based on what they call food frequency questionnaires. So it's basically you ask people how often you eat specific foods, and they only collect these, you know, every 4 years on average, in a bunch of these studies, that's the case. So yeah, you know, if you ask people what they eat, generally these types of questionnaires of, you know, I don't know, there's been some criticism of them in general within scientific literature, but they do a pretty good job of kind of ranking foods that you eat versus don't eat and kind of how frequently you eat them. So like, you know, if you eat yogurt, you know, if you're a person who eats raisins, you know, and that can give a sort of rank order. But in terms of like how much you eat of them. So like you said, with regard to ice cream, there's a tendency to say that you eat healthy foods more often than you do, and to say, well, yeah, you know, I didn't eat that whole tub of, you know, you're probably not going to report that you ate a whole tub of or a whole pint of, you know, Ben and Jerry's in front of the television when, you know, and you're going to say, well, yeah, I had a, you know, a small bowl, whatever. So that can skew the data.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Well, I'm an ice cream eater. I have been my whole life, and I'm up there. So one thing that we know, though, that got handed down like from grandparents, great-grandparents and all the way up, is that you have a glass of cold water when you have ice cream, because that helps to thin it out in your digestive system. Then it's easier for your body to digest, but you still get the fun of ice cream. So it's that water that might be a factor. And I'm wondering if that showed up in any of the small print any of the documentation that your guest has been looking at.
Gail, I got to ask, do you get more brain freeze when you do that, ice cream and cold water?
Oh, no, but you really feel good when you're having the water, because you know that you have the ice cream and it's not going to be like having ice cream.
Gail, thanks for the call. David, I'm guessing the research didn't get this granular. I don't know if there's going to be anything to that water ice cream combo, but it points toward another complicating factor. Usually we don't just eat one food. There might be interactions between different things we consume at the same time. How does that get factored into research?
Yeah, I can't say I have heard of that
Me
water
neither.
Theory. But, you know, I think that, you know, Yeah, could be a double dose of brain freeze there, but also could fill you up in some way, or at least temporarily. Yeah, and certainly in these studies, you know, they lump together all the ice creams, right? So it's not like, you know, they're not testing mint chocolate chip versus butter pecan versus, you know, it's just in these questionnaires, they just ask about ice cream. So there's a little, you know, you're looking through a kind of hazy lens there. But yeah, the other thing that in nutrition research that's very difficult is if you eat one food, that means you're basically not eating the other, right? Mm-hmm. And so like you can't, you know, people talk about randomized trials where you're testing say a pharmaceutical, you can give people a placebo. So they're either getting a drug or they're not getting the drug. And so you can do a very precise test of like adding one thing and, you know, versus, you know, not having it in the diet. But with diet, there's always a kind of replacement aspect, which is just an added thing that makes nutrition science research so very difficult. So if you're eating ice cream, what does that mean you're not eating, right? You know, whatever that replacement food might also have an effect on your health, or presumably does have an effect on your health. So it's an additional complication to why these studies are so very hard.
Yeah, I don't want placebo ice cream. David, as we wrap up, has this changed your ice cream eating behavior?
It hasn't. I mean, I have to confess that I was an ice cream eater before I did this research, and I remain an ice cream eater afterwards. But I would say, you know, it's probably not cause for going and digging in the freezer thinking that it's going to like, you know, protect you against diabetes. But, you know, my theory is that there probably are other good reasons for eating ice cream besides thinking about the health aspects.
David, thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Thanks so much. It was fun.
That was David Johns, public health historian and journalist. He's got a piece in The Atlantic about the science and the research when it comes to the health impact of ice cream. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time. Up next, a Wisconsin nutritionist joins us to help us sort out all that health news and food news we see and sort it into our decision making. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel overwhelmed sometimes by news about what is and isn't good for us to eat? How do you sort through it? Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're digging into the world of nutrition science and the connections between the food we eat, the health outcomes we can expect. Started with a public health historian who shared the scoop of a number of stories that found some possible health benefits to ice cream. Now, a nutritionist joins us with advice on how to evaluate the kind of food and health news we see and make good eating decisions. Breanne Thornton is a registered dietitian nutritionist at UW Health and UW Madison. Breanne, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm guessing as a nutritionist, you get questions from not just clients, but friends and others. Hey, should I eat blank? Is this healthy for me? Is this something that you hear all the time?
Yes, I commonly get questions from, you know, articles that people are reading or seeing online, and then I have to dive into the evidence to pick it apart and really understand the study that it's based on.
And then just talking to David just now, it seems really complicated in some cases to sort out the evidence. What did you think of his ice cream journey and what he shared there?
Yes, it is really difficult to pick apart the research that they're using to base these articles on. But I really think he had a great analysis that he shared with everyone. He talked about that it's an observational study, and observations don't always equal causation. And really, you know, the gold standard for evidence is a randomized clinical trial, which is difficult to do when you are studying nutrition and have maybe less funding for something like that.
I'm guessing there are some pretty solid nutritional guidelines out there. Like, I think we're always going to say that adding to our fruits and veggies is going to be good, and probably we're never going to benefit by eating more potato chips and soda, right?
Right. So we do know that ultra processed foods have negative impacts on our health, and the DASH diet and American Heart Association really have strong recommendations that are based on years of research, not just one study, that show decreasing intake of processed foods really is best for our health and more focused on those nutrient dense, less processed foods.
Now, how much of dietary advice is, you know, this is one size fits all, everybody can benefit from this, versus, hey, I'm a person with, you know, my own physical condition, maybe particular health conditions. How much is it helpful to individualize our diets?
It's really essential to individualize a diet. So we all have different genetics. We have different factors like age and gender that contribute to our health risk. And then we have multiple conditions to consider. So we can't just make one recommendation for all people for their heart if we're not considering their gut function or their blood sugars as well.
How do you, working with a client, how do you start to sort that out when a patient has those conditions? What do you do to recommend particular diets?
I really look at the whole person. So I start with learning about them and what they typically like to eat during the day, their physical activity level and what they're able to do. And then we look at their health record. So we look at their labs and their blood pressure, and we figure out where is a place that we want to start. And really, we focus on one or two things to do, because if we try to do more than that, often it gets challenging and maybe not maintainable to do.
I wanted to ask about that in particular. Like, we might know what's good for us, but setting up habits that fit those good foods into our lives, or in my case, habits that cut those bad foods out of our lives, how do we start to make those changes?
Yeah, it really starts with what you're ready to work on. So if you know it's getting to be summer and it's easier for you to eat vegetables, let's focus on that. If exercise is hard for you right now because of joint pain, we don't need to focus on that right now. But I think starting with something that you're ready to work on and that feels realistic is really important when we're trying to think about health goals, and knowing that it can take about 12 weeks to establish a new habit.
How do we make that habit successful? How do we, you know, not just go to the grocery store one time, buy that new food, maybe let it rot in the fridge, maybe eat it, but actually get to that 12 weeks of habit forming?
It really takes a lot of support from other people in your home, and you have to think about your internal motivation. Sometimes that number on the scale feels like it's really important, but really it's that we want to live a long, healthy life, and we want to see someone in our family have an exciting milestone like a wedding or have a baby. So we have to think about those factors that are really important to us. And then again, starting small. So if we want to increase our vegetable intake, maybe just buying one vegetable that we know we like, prep it, wash it, and chop it, have it ready to go. And then, you know, you're adding it to one meal versus saying, I'm going to eat salad every day. That can feel a little daunting.
Now you, I see, specialize in nutrition and interstitial cystitis. Can you talk about what goes into understanding nutrition with a, you know, a very particular condition like that?
Yeah, there's a lot of root causes that happen with our health. And so we need to consider what is causing these issues. When we have high blood pressure, you know, it's not a medication will lower blood pressure, but it's not getting to what's causing it. And it's what's causing it is maybe lack of activity, stress, or you need to lower your sodium intake. So I really focus on getting to the root cause and looking at the person as a whole to help them make changes.
Sometimes in the news, we get the idea, okay, this food is bad, this food is good. Can you talk about, you know, just moderation? Maybe we're not going to go on the all ice cream diet, but maybe it's not a disaster if we have it every week or two.
Right. So the DASH diet does encourage us to limit our sweets, but basically not every day. Less than five times a week is really reasonable. And we also need to think about the portion, which I think he mentioned. So a half a cup of ice cream is actually something that the food labels have changed the portion size because that doesn't seem real reasonable. So most portions are 2/3 of a cup. So we want to think about how often we're having it and the portion. And we want to think about balance, because if we say we're never going to eat ice cream again, that's probably not going to happen. And then we end up overdoing it in the future. And then we move away from a healthy habit we were trying to stick to.
Now, when you see a new news story about a nutritional study that finds food X or drink X is surprisingly good for you or surprisingly bad for you, how do you read that? How do you try to figure out, hey, is this something that we need to take into consideration here, or is this just kind of a blip?
Yeah, I learn a lot from my patients. They tell me about new products coming on the market, and I look at the food label and kind of see if there's any research that has popped up on it. But it really takes a lot of critical analysis when we're looking at a specific food or a specific research study to make sure that we are understanding exactly what it is and not just reading between the lines or reading one line from a research study.
a lot of times emotion can be tied into our food choices, maybe moral judgment if we're eating a food that's bad for us. How much does that affect your patients?
I think especially over the last couple of years with everything that's been going on in the world, emotional eating is a concern for people, and food does make us feel good in the moment, but we need to understand if there's any other healthy ways that we can cope with that emotion. So I think that getting the right support from your provider, maybe a mental health provider, and just making sure that you are supported in all ways so that we're not turning to food always for comfort. Yes, it's celebration and yes, it's nourishment, but we want to have healthy ways to cope with emotions as well.
As we wrap up, Brianna, I'll ask you the same question I asked David earlier. Just hearing about this journey about ice cream research affect your decision to eat ice cream more, less, not at all?
I don't think it does. You know, this is an interesting consideration. I think that it really just reiterates the DASH diet saying that all foods fit in moderation. And I think if you want to go out for ice cream with your family in the summer, you should do it.
We'll leave it there, Brianna. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Brianna Thornton, registered dietitian nutritionist with UW Health and UW Madison. She joined us today to help us understand a little bit about nutritional science and the connections between what we eat and how it affects our health. We heard earlier from public health historian David Merritt Johns about his article in The Atlantic looking at scientific findings about the health impacts of eating ice cream and why it's so complicated in some cases to sort out, to connect a straight line between the food we eat and our overall health. Coming up after the news, we look at the numbers on chronic student and sometimes teacher absenteeism during the height of the pandemic and the data we've seen since then. And we're hoping to hear your stories, whether you're a student, a parent of a student, if you work in a school, what are you seeing when it comes to not seeing kids in the classroom? Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can email right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, homelessness has gotten a lot of coverage in the media lately. Our guest makes the case that the way the media portrays homelessness can affect the way homeless people are treated, often for the worse. Now, new numbers are giving us a better picture of what the pandemic was like in schools. Across the state, chronic absenteeism, defined as missing more than 10% of school days, increased by about 4%, and student enrollment in public schools dropped by about 4.5%. No surprise, that was the height of the pandemic. But according to numbers for the following year, 2021 to 22, those high absence levels continued. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Parents, did your kids miss a lot of school during the early days of the pandemic? Is that still true now? If you work in schools, if you're a student in school, are you seeing more empty seats than you used to? What do you think has changed? What could bring kids back in? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Corinne Hess is a K-12 education reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Corey, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to situate this in time. Now, we've got a school year going on. Now, we don't have the data for this current school year. The pandemic breaks out in 2020. We've got the school year 2021 to 2022. Or 20 to 21, no surprise, absenteeism goes up. The hope, I think, was that in the more recent numbers, we'd see things go back to normal. That it sounds like, if I'm reading you right, Corey, that's not what happened.
No, in fact, unfortunately, it got worse.
Right. Can you talk about the changes, the trends we saw from that full-on pandemic year to the year, the hoped-for year of recovery?
Yeah, so before the pandemic, average attendance rates were hovering around 94%. Then the year after the pandemic, it went down to 93%. And now it's even lower at 91%, which means, you know, these percentages kind of are hard to wrap your head around. But what that means is Wisconsin students are missing nearly a month of school. And again, that was for last year, as you pointed out. We won't have the data for this school year until March of 2024, unfortunately.
And this wasn't the same everywhere. Milwaukee Public High School students only at school apparently 70% of the time in the last school year. Can you talk about some of the disparities you found when you looked at the numbers?
Yeah, there were a lot of disparities. So in looking at the numbers, the school districts that did the worst, like you pointed out, Milwaukee Public Schools, the absentee rate and chronic absenteeism was really bad. But also larger districts, you know, in Southeast Wisconsin, the larger urban school districts, there was a lot of absenteeism. Also Madison Metropolitan School District, but then also the smaller rural districts, you know, they also weren't good in northern Wisconsin. So there's just a lot of disparity. Also, statewide data showed that 58% of Black students were chronically absent and 44% of Native American students. That compares to 15% of white students.
You asked some people in your reporting, you know, possible ideas why. What kind of things did you hear about why the absenteeism not only persisted after the initial year of the pandemic, but got worse?
You know, some of the ideas that people had were just students' mental health just has not been the same since the pandemic. Other people thought that maybe just the need to be in school isn't as great. You know, people worked from home, studied from home. And so just the whole needing to be in school all the time, a lot of people don't think it's as necessary, unfortunately. And then somebody did say maybe there's too much emphasis on staying home if you are exposed to COVID. I'm not sure if that is true. But yeah, there's just been some different ideas.
And as we wrap up, Corey, this isn't just Wisconsin. You put this in a national perspective in your reporting. We are not alone here in these issues.
No, not at all. This is not a Wisconsin problem. It's a national problem. So there was a survey done not too long ago, and, you know, 72% of school districts that answered all said that they are facing the same thing, with students not going to school, but also teachers are more absent. And so teachers are calling in a lot more, too.
Corey, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That was WPR K-12 education reporter Corey Hess talking about chronic student and teacher absenteeism during the pandemic. We're going to follow up on that conversation, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a kid in schools? Is the dividing line for you over whether you send your kid to school if they're a little bit sick? Is it different than it was, say, 3 years ago? Do you see more absences in your school, whether you're a parent, a student yourself, a teacher, or you work in a school? What are you seeing in your district? What do you think is causing that and this overall increase in absenteeism? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Don Kramer joins us now, researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Don co-authored a report on student absenteeism in the 2020 through 2021 school year. Don, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you, Rob, for having me today.
Your latest report on this, and this is something you've been following over time, Don, is on that, you know, the first full year after the pandemic outbreak. Can you take us through some of what struck you about the numbers you saw there?
Sure. We were looking at this for about 5-10 years, really concerned because chronic absenteeism was high at 10% even before the pandemic. And then looking at the pandemic years, it reached up to 16% for the state. And we were hoping that it was just going to be one blip based on the pandemic. But then looking at the data from the 2021-2022 year, it just kept going up to 22%.
I want to talk about the stakes a little bit, Don, here. It may seem obvious, but, you know, being at school, participating in classes, I assume is good for learning. Not being there is going to hurt students' progress. You're a former teacher yourself. Can you talk about what's at stake if kids aren't showing up at school as often?
Absolutely. That's the basic thing. You can't learn something if you're not there to hear what's going on. It's also interesting here because we thought oftentimes when we imagine someone not going to school, we think of like that high school kid, you know, skipping class. But when we looked at the data, it was also those elementary school students and those middle school students. We really saw the biggest increase when we looked at our data up through 21 of middle school students missing more school. Like that was the sharpest uptick, which we were surprised at.
We talked to Corey a little bit there about some of the disparities. You saw some big differences for different demographics around the state. What struck you from those early pandemic numbers?
Yeah, we weren't looking specifically at the students, but we were looking at the demographics of the school. Mm-hmm. And it did seem that there was a tie to schools with higher low-income, students from low-income houses tended to have higher absentee rates. Schools with higher non-white populations tend to have higher rates of chronic absenteeism, and schools with higher rates of students with disabilities also had higher rates of chronic absenteeism. So we don't know if any of them are causing something else or if there's another factor causing all of these issues, but any of these by themselves usually is a concern, but all of them together, definitely a bunch of issues for us to deal with.
I imagine you're probably crunching some of the numbers from that 21 to 22 report that came out and eagerly awaiting the current school year's numbers. But the fact that, you know, it was bad and then it's got actually worse in that following year. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's just incredible to see how much it's a statewide problem. You know, we looked at like the five largest districts in the state, and they had 20,000 additionally chronic absent students. But throughout the rest of the state, there was 30,000 additional chronically absent students in the school year. It's just incredible to think of like how many students that really is in addition to what was already happening.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jackie is with us in Marinette. Jackie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Jackie?
Well, so I had a thought about the absentees in the 2021 school year. You know, I think that it could somewhat be attributed to the masking regulations that were in place that year. You know, the kids didn't want to wear masks 8 hours a day, you know, the ones that did go. My own daughter, she was in first grade in 2020, so she was in second grade in 2021, and they offered virtual learning options that year as well. So we opted for her to do virtual learning the second semester of school in during that winter holiday time when there would be a lot of exposure to germs. And, you know, I seen firsthand how that affected her mental health even at that young age. So I do think it was right on when someone previously said that mental health has not recovered. We ended up putting her in counseling in second grade.
Wow, Jackie, thank you so much for being willing to share that. I really appreciate it. Jackie giving us some insight, Don, into what might be going through the minds of a lot of parents as they considered in-person versus virtual, or virtual is not an option. Do we send the kid to school given they're worried about their health?
Yeah, absolutely. With the 21-22 year, I'm assuming many of the virtual options have gone away. So where that might have kept the absentee numbers down previously, 21-22 didn't really have as many virtual options.
And then Jackie also mentioned, and we'd heard this from Corey as well, Don, mental health concerns for kids. Now, this is not something that shows up in the data sources you're using, but do you have thoughts on that as a possible factor?
We definitely talk about it in the sense of relationships in the school. You know, how do we build those individual students, get them back into school? And a lot of that comes down to mental health also, just building that relationship between the teacher and the students and just the students and the overall school culture. How much is it dealing with a relationship, building those back up? It's pretty easy to lose a relationship. It's definitely takes more work and more time to build that relationship back, which I think of mental health as part of that whole environment.
Jackie, thanks again for calling. Best to your daughter. We are talking to Wisconsin Policy Forum researcher Don Kramer about his report on student absenteeism in Wisconsin. Went up in the early days of the pandemic, not a big surprise, but continued to go up in the last school year. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We're hearing the numbers. Do you have a story behind those numbers in your own family, in your own school or district? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Wisconsin Policy Forum researcher Don Kramer about student absenteeism in the schools. He and his organization have been following the numbers. They went, things got a little worse with chronic absenteeism among students in the early days of the pandemic, and then a year later got worse again. You can join in with your story, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Liz joins us now in Eau Claire. Liz, hi.
Hi there. Am I supposed to be on the radio? Or the
you're phone? On right. You're on right now. Yep. Go
okay,
for it.
Okay. Here's my question, or what I'm wondering is, I am assuming that the data for absenteeism takes away, does not count people who are enrolled in virtual school, because that really can't be determined, the absenteeism.
Oh, interesting.
So,
Liz, thanks for the call. I think I get it, Don. If I attend school virtually, am I counted as, not absent? How did that fit into this data?
Virtual schools are included in the data. And if your public school was conducting classes virtually, they had some metric for how they would count someone as present or absent. Sometimes they had to turn, the student had to turn on their camera. Sometimes there was a roll call at a certain time of the day or at a certain time of the period. But yeah, if your classes were virtual, there was a mechanism for counting the student as present or absent. They are included.
I hope that answers your question, Liz. We'll go now to Pat in Eau Claire. Pat, hi.
Hi. My comment is I'm a grandma, and I have a middle schooler and a high schooler grandchildren, and I have another middle schooler in California. And starting as soon as fall started this last year, this school year, viruses went around constantly, and my grandkids caught all of them and were extremely sick. My granddaughter in middle school had influenza between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And my grandson probably had the same thing, but he didn't go to the doctor. They missed about 15 days of school before Christmas. They were sick in bed. They did all of their homework from bed virtually. After Christmas, and they went back to school, they caught another virus that
oh, no.
went around. They were bad colds. They were sick continually. My grandson in California experienced the same thing. And the school district sent a letter that my granddaughter had been gone 17 days and they were going to report her to the county for being out of school too much. She had all her schoolwork done. She's an A student. And in February...
We don't have too much time left, but thank you so much for sharing that. Best to the health of all your grandkids. Wow. And Don, I wonder, we had that early COVID year where kids... we're staying out of school to not spread COVID and not catching those colds and flus. And, well, it sounds like Pat's grandkids were unfortunately catching up on all of that. Do we think that that could be one of the factors here?
Absolutely. And that's an interesting way to put it. We are catching up on all those viruses we didn't catch in the years when we were alone and masked up when we were together anyway. So, that's definitely an idea there. And just thinking of what she said, mm-hmm. these good students are sick. The chronic absenteeism rates don't care why you are out of school, and they don't distinguish with what kind of student you are. It's just you're either in the building or you are not in the building. Sorry, you're either attending mm-hmm. maybe virtually or not, or you are not attending, and that's how they determine chronic absenteeism.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Mary now in Madison. Mary, hi.
Hi, I'm a mother of three from elementary to middle school, and I just want to say since COVID, I have called them in more frequently and not said that they were sick, but called them in for a mental health day. And I have found support from their teachers in that. They provide stuff for them to do at home and think that that is important. And I think that your answer from your expert was a bit of a cop-out, because building relationships with teachers and the school, everybody is already overworked, overstressed. They need to put more social workers in schools, more aides. They need to focus more on mental health and put that as a priority, because teachers see that as a priority as well. If a kid is depressed or anxious, they're not going to learn. And so the day's wasted.
Mary, thank you so much for sharing your experience with your kids. And Don, we've talked about school. You and I have talked about school staffing before, efforts to bring in more emergency teachers. Mary's pointing to, yeah, there may not be the staff here to make that kind of connection, to do that kind of outreach to tackle this absenteeism problem.
Absolutely. And if we could get the funding to support all that staffing, I think a lot of people would support that idea. Building those relationships aren't just between the teachers, but also the social workers, the guidance counselors, all of that community of the school fosters the relationships that I was talking about.
Mary, thanks a lot for that call. Peter is with us now in Viroqua. Hi, Peter.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to share a story. When my son was a freshman, when COVID hit, so the school he was in at the time went virtual. And after his freshman year, he transferred to another school. So I saw his official transcripts, and they marked him down absent 26 days at the school he had been at during the first part of COVID. And I tried to get a straight answer out of the school as to how this happened, and was kind of dismissed, like, oh, it's no big deal if it's on his transcripts that he's missed school this much. And ultimately, he talked to one of his teachers, and that teacher, who had also failed him, was the one that marked him absent 26 times. And it was because he did not click the right button.
Oh, no.
When he went on to take the virtual class. So I just wanted to mention this, is it's possible that some of the statistics, there might be a plus or minus, you know, deviance as to how accurate the statistics are. There's no doubt that there's more absence, but I wonder, under the stress of the pandemic, if things slip through the cracks like this.
I gotcha, Peter. Don, we're just out of time, Peter. Thanks for calling in. Don, we were making stuff up as we went in a lot of cases. Did that throw off the data?
Yeah, and we actually talked about that in our report, just because, especially in those early days of the pandemic, there were no clear guidelines on what constituted as an absence or actually, there was no definition of what a present student was, especially in a virtual situation. So we do talk about how this data that we're getting from the state, it's definitely not completely accurate, but it's definitely a preponderance of evidence to show that the data was in that direction, though, that chronic absenteeism did increase.
Peter, thanks a lot for that call. Don, as we wrap up, you know, the official public health emergency for COVID just ended. Schools clearly still feeling some of the fallout here. Leave us with some solutions and policies you're hoping we're going to see.
Yeah, we talk about policy a lot, and it's tough to legislate something that deals with absenteeism, because so much of it is based on student by student and dealing with the issues that happen individually. Whatever is going to work for the high school students is probably not going to work for the middle school and the elementary school students too. It's a really easy answer to say that we wish there were more funding to provide personnel that could reach out to the absent students. But I think individual districts really have to think about how they're going to work with the individual problems or issues that are happening locally.
Don, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Don Kramer, researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He talked to us about a large number of students missing school starting at the beginning of the pandemic and not necessarily getting any better, according at least to the latest data. Love to hear from you if you, your school district, your family has tackled this problem and maybe found solutions that you'd want to share with the world. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Did your district find a way to reach out and help solve some of the problems that led to higher chronic absenteeism? Again, email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a new book looks at a long-term effort to clean up the environment in northeastern Wisconsin. Meet the authors of Paper Valley, The Fight for the Fox River Cleanup. If you were part of that story yourself, I'm sure Kate and her guests would love to hear from you tomorrow as well. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. I've heard from a lot of people over the years who think of baking as therapeutic. We've talked about that here on Central Time, especially during the early days of COVID. A lot of people found comfort in baking sourdough bread, other bread, cookies, whatever. Turns out there's really something to that idea, and we'll find out why tomorrow on Food Friday. We'll hear from a psychotherapist who's also a master baker. He wrote a cookbook with baking recipes and therapeutic advice to get the most out of our baking. Want to hear from you. Do you find baking or other forms of cooking to be a form of comfort, maybe even a way to relieve stress or anxiety? Share your story now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then tomorrow, listen to the Food Friday conversation with the author of the new book, Mind Over Batter, 75 Recipes for Baking as Therapy. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.